Okay, so I changed the title of my talk a little bit because when I first sent the title in, I didn't really know what I was talking about. Now, I hope to convince you I do know what I'm talking about. And it's precisely the subject that we've just been worrying about, which is I want to address the question of what happens when, let's say in the case of a young, rapidly spinning star subject to the R-mode instability, how does it spin down? What do we mean by spinning down? What is the evolution? And the idea that this is related to thermal effects because the magnitude of the thermal effects and dissipation plays a crucial role in what actually happens, as indeed Lee was just saying. Now, there's a simple idea here that's in the paper by Owen and several authors. It's also assumed by John Friedman and myself in our early work, that somehow these instabilities grow to some amplitude and then there's some mysterious way in which they act back on the star and the star spins down. And so you're constantly being able to describe in the long-term evolution the perturbation as a relatively small linear perturbation on a background stationary axisymmetric stellar equilibrium model. So as this thing evolves, you have some background model which is evolving and always has some sort of unstable perturbation on it. That would be a nice picture to have. In this picture, the angular velocity, the energy, and so on of this background is smoothly evolving functions on a long time scale, tau. So I'll use tau to represent the time scale of evolution, the time parameter on which this supposed background star is evolving. So in particular, the angular velocity of the star evolves in time, and that's driven by the loss of energy or the loss of angular momentum by through the perturbation. So that's of order, let's say, epsilon squared or delta v squared. So I'm really averaging over the short-term periodicity of the perturbation and looking at the long-term secular spin down. But what I'm going to argue is that this picture isn't in general true. In general, there won't be such an equilibrium sequence defined in this way, where you can set up rho and p and omega as functions of tau. And therefore, that if we really want to study the real evolution of non-axis of the R mode in situations like this, certainly in the case of spin down of a young star, but also in the cases of, let's say, models for LMXBs where the gravitational radiation is episodic and therefore there's periods where it's driving the spin of the star fairly rapidly, then accurate treatments are going to have to build some sort of non-axisymmetric equilibrium models or integrate the physics dynamically. I'm not in the way that we've just been talking about in the Font and Sergio Ulis work. I'm not going to come down and say what I think actually happens, but I'm going to show you why the simple picture can't be true. First, let's just talk about the virial theorem. If you're talking about a sequence that loses energy and angular momentum, a star, an equilibrium star that loses energy and angular momentum to radiation, then that doesn't automatically allow you to move it from one equilibrium to another, because we know from the virial theorem that there's a link between changes in energy and angular momentum and in the internal thermal energy, so that somehow the action of viscosity or whatever is going to change your thermal energy has to cooperate with you. And it's really, I want to make that statement rigorous. I want to show exactly how that works. But I won't use the virial theorem. Instead, I'll use a more powerful theorem or a couple of results from this paper by Raphael Sorkin and myself, which appeared in 1977 in Annals of Physics, New York. This is a paper which I think is full of interesting results, and I think practically nobody has ever read this paper. And so I'm really glad to have a chance finally to present it to an audience of people who might find it interesting. Our main object in this paper was to study the relationship between energy extremals and solutions of field equations. So in a simple mechanics situation that you encounter when you first begin teaching equilibrium to undergraduates or at high school, you know that you've got a stable equilibrium if you've got a ball at the bottom of a well, an unstable if it's at the top, and if you're on the side, then it's not an equilibrium at all. So that there's a relationship in these simple systems between being an extremal of the energy, either maximum or minimum, and being in equilibrium. It's also clear that in more complicated situations, that relationship isn't quite so straightforward. And so in this paper, we wanted to address that question of how are these things related. And we found, really, it's a very rich question. We found a lot of interesting material. We were mainly interested in the fluid case, but it led us in funny directions. In particular, just as an aside, we were able to look at electromagnetism and address the question of are there action principles for electromagnetism? Are there ways of deriving Maxwell's equations from a variational principle, from an action principle? If you look in the textbooks, you'll find that there are two kinds of variational principles for Maxwell's equations. One is where you write down the action, and then you vary it with respect to the vector potential. You introduce the vector potential and then vary. The other is where you don't introduce the vector potential. You stay with E and B, but the variations are not free. They're constrained. And in fact, the constraint is basically the equation that says that you're allowed to that there is a vector potential for a particular E and B. We, of course, you could ask, are we just not clever enough to invent variational principles, action principles for Maxwell's equations, in which you can just start with E and B and have an unconstrained, a very simple variational principle as you would for a mechanical system like this, the simplest kind of thing. Are we just not clever enough to invent that? Well, what Rafael and I were able to show is that actually you can prove that that's not possible. And the proof is based on one very simple observation, which is that the energy of a stationary electric field is not necessarily an extremal. So you can have, for instance, an electric field with nice parallel lines of electric force. Energy is 1 over 8 pi e squared, the energy density. And you can have a static electric field. And if you perturb that with a change in the electric field, then that's not an extremum, because the electric field is not zero. It changes the first order in the perturbation. That's a trivial observation, but it turns out that's enough to be able to prove that there is no, it's impossible to find a variational principle, an action principle, for Maxwell's equations that is based upon free, unconstrained variations of E and B. So it's that kind of thing that we were looking at, and that's relevant because we're going to see the same sort of thing in the fluid case, where, again, in the fluid case, you can have stationary solutions which are not extrema of the energy. So here's a theorem from that paper. And it's phrased in the following way. A time-independent set, phi, rho naught, s, and v, which is a solution of Newton's gravitational field equation and Euler's equation. So it's time-independent and solves Newtonian gravity. The paper was mainly in relativity, but we specialized certain particular significant results to Newtonian gravity as well, and I'm quoting them in Newtonian gravity. So this is basically a model for a star. You have a Newtonian gravitational field. You solve Euler's fluid equations, and it's time independent. Well, you can have that if and only if the total energy is an extremum, total energy of that solution is an extremum, against all stationary perturbations that obey 3 plus 1 auxiliary conditions. But the main three are, when you're perturbing it, you don't change the number of particles. When you're perturbing it, you don't change the specific entropy. And when you're perturbing it, you don't change the kinetic energy. You don't change the velocity in direction that's parallel to the existing velocity in the star. And then if in addition this set is axisymmetric, so we didn't necessarily assume it was axisymmetric, but if it's additionally axisymmetric, then the perturbations that we're talking about here are also meant to be axisymmetric. That's a kind of a weak extra thing. But the main thing is that there's three constraints on your perturbations. So if you restrict yourself to perturbations that obey those three constraints, then the energy, the total energy of this star, is an extremum. It's a corollary of that, that if you take the total energy of a time-independent solution, and you want to change it to first order, so it's not an extremum, you make a first order change, then there's only three ways of doing it, and that's by violating one of these three constraints. So you can add particles, in which case you change the energy by proportional to the mass that you're adding, and the injection energy, basically, of the particle. That's the enthalpy, and that's the gravitational potential energy, that's the kinetic energy. Or you could add heat, so you change the specific entropy. Or you can add kinetic energy, so you change the velocity in a way that has a component parallel to the existing velocity. Now, how is that relevant? Well, what is relevant is that, now let's talk about this sequence of equilibria that we suppose we have, which the R modes are pushing you along. You are making first order changes. This change on the slow time scale, tau, you're making first order changes in the energy because you're losing energy to gravitational waves. You're making first order changes in the energy of this equilibria as you move along the sequence. And this tells you that the only way that you can do that and remain on a sequence of equilibria is if the energy is changing, because we're not changing the number of particles through gravitational radiation, but we are adding heat through viscosity and we are changing the velocity. So you can change the velocity, and that's the action of that's produced somehow by the radiation reaction or whatever on the star. And this is the heat component. So these two are the only ways you can change the energy and still remain along a sequence of equilibrium. So let's ask, can that happen? So first, this velocity change, the kinetic energy, if I have a simple star, let's say a rigidly rotating star, this is nothing more than just omega times dj by d tau. You're changing the energy by omega times the change in the angular momentum over this period, a small period of time during which the star is evolving. And this dj by d tau is the only way the star loses angular momentum is through gravitational radiation losses. Then the ds by dt, that's a viscosity term, and we can write that down without too much trouble. dE by dt, well, we know how the total energy of the star changes. Again, it's the total energy. It's not just transferring energy from kinetic motion to heat or something like that. The internal energy transfer is created by viscosity. This is an actual energy lost by the star. And it's lost through gravitational radiation, which is related to the angular momentum loss by multiplying by the pattern speed of the mode. And then there's also something that's probably not very important, but may be important in some cases, the loss of energy through the neutrinos that are generated in the bulk viscosity, which may scatter several times and dump most of the energy in the star, but some of the energy they carry away. So there's a small amount of energy being lost there. But the main thing is these two terms. And the key thing is that these two terms are related. So when I put it back in that formula, the total energy loss, I'll take this term over here, and that's the pattern speed is 2/3 of the angular velocity of the star times the radiated angular momentum. And here's the kinetic energy change, which is the radiated angular momentum times omega. And then there's these two terms. I brought this neutrino thing over to the other side. This is the total net heating. This is the entropy generation by viscosity minus whatever is taken away by the neutrinos. So this is the sort of net thermal energy input into the star. And you have to satisfy this equation. And these two terms are essentially the same apart from the coefficient. So I bring this over here and I get a minus 1/3. Remember, dj by dt is negative. I'm losing angular momentum. So I have a positive number over here, and this is going to be a positive number. But in order for me to be able to progress through a sequence of equilibria, these two numbers have to be the same. And it seems to me that that's too much to ask. It's too much to expect that the mechanics of whatever is producing heating, whether it's a boundary layer underneath the crust or whatever, is going to just satisfy exactly that 1/3 omega dj by dt. So I think it's very unlikely that this equality will be satisfied, and therefore unlikely that the way the R modes push the system will be through a nice sequence of axisymmetric equilibria. And this is exactly what Don was saying in the case in the integrations of the Maclaurin spheroids, for instance. That doesn't happen. The star goes off into the plane of Riemann ellipsoids and winds up as a Dedekind ellipsoid, but it doesn't follow a nice sequence of almost Maclaurin spheroids as it evolves. Yeah, okay, you can, if there's just general background cooling, then that can be in there as well. Yeah. Yeah, but is the star going to do that? Is there a mechanism? I think that requires a conspiracy. That's my feeling, is it requires a conspiracy in the star to do that. Well, we can talk about that now, or I mean, maybe let's leave it to the discussion, because I can present what I think is an alternative picture. So I'm not sure what happens instead, but I can describe one possible alternative. It seems to me the next most simple alternative is that the system evolves through equilibria that are stationary in some other frame, which are like the Riemann ellipsoids in the Maclaurin sequence. That is, they have a shape, but the shape is highly non-symmetrical and is tumbling in the inertial frame. But there's another frame, the frame in which that shape is stationary, in which the thing does evolve in a stationary way. Now that's what happens. That's what I think we're being driven to if the gravitational radiation dominates. If the amplitude of the mode it grows through gravitational radiation to be of order one, then I think this will be true. If the mode is limited to very small amplitude, I'm not sure this is the right picture of what happens. But this is one possible alternative, which is that you're almost in equilibrium, and the equilibrium is actually stationary in a rotating frame. Now, I think I can show you how you can calculate this angular velocity of the rotating object from energy considerations as before. Because although Sarkin and I didn't, in our paper, go into the way the energy equilibrium theorem works in a rotating frame, it works just as well in the rotating frame as in the inertial frame. And so if I let a star represent quantities referred to the inertial frame, to the rotating frame, then dE star by d tau star, this it's important to talk about times for reasons I'll say in a minute, evolving in this rotating frame, is equal to the angular velocity of the fluid, which is now reduced from what it was in the inertial frame by the fact that you're in a rotating frame. And here, I've just allowed myself to do an integration in case there's a differential rotation here. So I have I have the local specific angular momentum and local angular momentum density, rather, and that's being radiated away. And then I have a local entropy density as well, so a local specific entropy here, which is being radiated away. Now, that term isn't changing, but all the action is in the way these terms behave. The bottom line is that the gravitational radiation that's taken away as seen in the rotating frame has an extra factor of the patterns, basically the pattern speed minus omega star, because this omega star, because the time derivative that we're talking about, that is stationary in the rotating frame, is a time derivative that follows, that sort of wraps itself around, and is a killing vector, but is a killing vector composed of these two killing vectors. And so when you're constructing energy and angular momentum and taking time derivative perturbations in general relativity, this is the time derivative you're using. So that the actual energy and angular momentum being radiated, for example, the angular momentum, is different from it measured in the rotating frame, is different from the angular momentum radiated as measured in the non-rotating frame by this extra factor. The angular momentum itself is the same. It's the flux, the angular momentum flux that far away that is changed by this factor. And there's a similar factor that enters into the energy, except that enters into the energy squared. And so there is the relationship between energy flux and angular momentum in the inertial frame has omega p minus omega star squared in it, or omega p. When you put those things together, you get a non-trivial equation for omega star. So let me, again, to just illustrate this, assume that the angular velocity of the object in the inertial frame is constant, that it's in uniform rotation, so I don't have to carry all these integrals around. And then I'll get the pattern speed over here. I have this extra, this is in the energy. I have that extra factor. I've canceled out one of these factors. This is the angular momentum in the in the inertial frame. This is the angular momentum loss in the inertial frame. This is the angular momentum loss in the rotating frame, and this is the energy loss in the rotating frame, referred back to the angular momentum in the inertial frame. And so when you put, so if you look at this in a simple case, let's suppose I didn't have any heating at all. I was doing the perfect fluid thing, which is what we've just been talking about in Yuri's talk, and Don made remarks about the Maclaurin spheroids. If you look at that, then the way you can make these two equal now, which couldn't have been equal before because they had a 2/3 and a 1 in front of them, now they have this common factor of omega p minus omega star, and you can set omega star equal to omega p, and they both are equal to 0. And that tells you that the star will evolve as a stationary solution. You satisfy this stationarity condition. It evolves as a stationary solution in a frame which is rotating with the perturbation, rotating with the pattern speed of the perturbation. And that's exactly what happens in these simulations with the Maclaurin spheroids. It just grows and initially stays in stays stationary in the frame in which the original perturbation was stationary. Now, as the thing becomes nonlinear, things will change, because over here, if we have nonlinear perturbation, then we don't have a simple angular velocity here that we're multiplying by. We have a a three-dimensional velocity field, and we have to dot that into the radiated angular momentum, and the whole thing becomes much more complicated. And so you don't expect this equality to be maintained, even in the absence of thermal effects, forever. And indeed, that's eventually the thing spins down. So the spin down that you eventually are going to see is a change in the frame in which the perturbation at any one time along the sequence, the perturbed object or the non-linearly perturbed object, is stationary. So it has a shape which is stationary in some frame, and that frame I expect will spin down right down to zero frequency, and then the radiation will go away. But that will be not approximated by a sequence of, let's say, axisymmetric solutions. The axisymmetric case only holds if omega star is equal to zero. Now, if you put back the thermal input here, then there's some thermal radiation, some net thermal radiation, or thermal input d on the same time scale. And if you gather all these terms together, what you get is that the, again, in this case where we're starting out with a uniformly rotating object, pattern speed minus the angular velocity of the frame in which things should be stationary is a ratio of these two rates. One is twice the energy generated by thermal processes, and the other is minus the loss of angular momentum. And the ratio of those two is this angular velocity, and that's enough to determine omega star. Of course, if omega star is driven negative, so this thing is actually larger than omega p, that's a limit on the thermal dissipation, which I think will shut off the instability. So that tells you if the thermal dissipation is larger than some critical value, if the heating is larger than some critical value, which when you put the numbers in is a half of the energy lost to gravitational radiation, then you'll shut off the instability completely. And I think that's exactly the relation that you have in the linear case. When you look at the time scales, there's a factor of two or something somewhere. And there is a third if you're looking at angular momentum, and a half if you're looking at energy. So this tells you that if you have enough energy generation, you'll shut off the instability completely. If you're right at that critical energy generation rate, then omega star will equal omega p, and then omega star will equal zero, and then the star, that omega star equals zero, is in this picture the value that allows you to regard the system as a perturbed axisymmetric star that's just spinning down. So there's only one value of the energy generation, the thermal energy generation, which allows you to sit on a nice sequence of axisymmetric stars spinning down. If you slightly exceed that value, then you'll shut off the instability completely. If you are slightly below that value, then you'll find that the system is represented by a star which has a pattern which is rotating with the angular velocity omega star, and that it's an equilibrium in that frame rotating with omega star rather than in the inertial frame. All right, well, that's that this remark relates to the fact that, which I should have just said, which is if you're a little bit below the critical thermal generation heat input rate, omega star is going to be quite small, and so you're actually going to have a figure which is rotating rather slowly in the inertial frame, and nothing like the kind of perturbations that we're talking about. Omega star will be the angular velocity here. This omega star is the angular velocity, or the pattern speed, let's say, of the gravitational radiation as well. So this is where you're going to see the gravitational wave. So it's very important, I think, to sort out these questions. If you really want to model the evolution and track it in gravitational radiation, you've got to see the time dependence of that angular velocity. Okay, so that's the claim I'm making, which is that we're not going to find nice, simple perturbations of evolving axisymmetric stars unless there's a conspiracy which allows the heating to have exactly a value that matches the energy loss rate in gravitational radiation. But the theorem applies to differential rotation. There's no assumption. I only put in omega to make equations simple. But the omega, in the early statement of the theorem, omega can be a function of position. So the theorem. The theorems are all in terms of local quantities. The velocity is any local and not necessarily even axisymmetric function here. This is if I add a small amount of entropy someplace affecting n particles, then this is the total change in energy it produces. So this is just, you know, sticking something in somewhere. But so I really ought to, instead of having n, I should integrate over little n, the number density over the whole star. But it's just a way of writing it to make it simple. But the theorem is very much unlocal. It's all very local, yeah. Yeah. So you can do anything you want locally. Yeah. So here I put the real integral in. Instead of having total number of particles, I took a number density and integrated. Over the volume of the star, whatever your what, and this is the local energy generation rate, entropy generation rate. Yeah.
I'm going to make a comment. It's probably irrelevant, but it's nice. I mean, the nature of your argument would prove that you can't. I mean, with axisymmetric equilibrium, it has to do with dealing with the dissipation rates are in some sense independent of how you're forcing them.
Yes. Right.
Because there is this whole sequence of other possibilities of non-axisymmetric and stationary rotating frame. I won't give the direction you're going, it sounds very plausible, but you could turn it around. And if you were to argue, for example, if you do a structure of shockwave or in reconnection physics, where you would say, fine, it's a conspiracy that the dissipation of the shock always adjusts just to give the conservation laws. But that's the point, that is the external boundary conditions drive the system to a state.
Yeah.
In which the dissipation must adjust so as to give what it has to do.
Yeah.
This case has been argued for years over reconnection, and the results, both from experiment and a lot of nonlinear work, is that indeed the claim that the dissipation has to adjust to the external boundary conditions seems to be true. That is, surprisingly, the dissipation is not free to do whatever it wants. It has to adjust to the macroscopic environment. So, you know, it seems to me that such a situation somewhat undermines the force of your original argument. However, the fact that you have an alternate set of equilibria you can go to, the thing you might go to, strengthens it. As the question is only going to get answered by people looking for
I agree with that. I agree with that. I worried about whether there should be a conspiracy or not. I think that's why I distinguished two cases and only really addressed one, which was where the amplitude could grow to quite large value, and the gravitational radiation is really dominant over the dissipation. I think if because there, I think there really isn't any conservation law. There are this whole sequence of equilibria in rotating frames that will be giving off gravitational radiation in the inertial frame. But the other regime, where the amplitude of the R mode is limited by dissipative effects, and maybe you only ever get to 10 to the minus 2 or something like that in the amplitude, there I'm not so sure what happens. I would be surprised if it was enough of a conspiracy that you exactly go along this nice equilibrium axisymmetric sequence. But I don't have a very clear idea of what the alternative is, what the sequence ought to look like. So this is very open.
If you put it in an axisymmetric glass wall, like Urey's thing, that provides a constraint.
Yes.
That
might. That might. Yeah,
but
you might induce meridional circulation. You might have a very much more complex velocity pattern, which is not what we usually talk about when we talk about the sequence of equilibria. So I think that would be one way out, is that you have a convective circulation, and that would have strong implications then for the R modes and for the nuclear physics and cooling and neutrinos and everything else. So I don't know. Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
And I think that neutron stars are very unlikely to get anything like meridional circulation because of the space is gravified. But that also tells you that there is another variable that you have, which you didn't put in here, which is the composition of the star.
Yes, that's right. Yes, that's right. That's not in here. Yeah, I think it probably doesn't have much to do, because unless you're allowed to change the number of particles and you're changing. That's right. Yeah. So that's an extra degree of freedom. Yeah. But I still think that would give you another term. There would be differences in injection energy for the different species, and you'd gain energies over here. But again, I'd still worry that in order to move along the sequence of equilibria, you'd have to have a conspiracy among all those terms. Yuri? Yeah. If this term is totally absent and we don't have these composition effects, then you have what I described here. You have a very simple thing where that's the energy loss, that's the kinetic energy loss. They're not balanced by anything. This thing is zero, and it's therefore impossible. There's a two-thirds here and a one here. It's impossible to go along the equilibrium. And then you do what happens in the Maclaurin spheroids. You get some very disturbed object, and it becomes like these Riemann ellipsoids. The Riemann ellipsoids in the incompressible case are objects that have an ellipsoidal shape that moves in the inertial frame, but within them they have circulation and shear as well. So if you go to the frame in which the shape is constant, you still have velocities going around inside, and that's the general incompressible self-gravitating object, and that's, I presume, what this thing would get forced into, some compressible analog of that. But only after you've achieved some stable equilibrium. So after you've shed or you allow gravitational waves to carry away that extra angular momentum. Yeah, so if you let me just get a blank transparency here and I'll, it's okay, over here now. So what happens, okay, thanks. What happens in the Maclaurin spheroids is that I'm not going to draw this very well. In fact, I'm not going to draw it very well with that at all. But there's some parameter like a total angular velocity and total angular momentum rather, and angular velocity, which I'll call omega star, the angular velocity of the shape. And there's some curve in this plane, which is the Maclaurin spheroids, which are uniformly rotating. So if you go to the angular, the frame in which this is the, which is rotating with this angular velocity, then the Maclaurins are at rest in that frame. There's no residual velocity. And then somewhere along the Maclaurins, there's a branching off point for, and I think it goes up, but doesn't really matter, for Dedekind ellipsoids. Dedekind ellipsoids, this can't be omega star, because Dedekind ellipsoids are at zero frequency. So what am I plotting? Yeah, maybe J versus Z or something like that, yeah. These have omega star equals zero. I'm not sure what I'm plotting here, but...
omega should go down.
Yeah, so...
Omega should go down.
That's right. I don't know what I'm plotting. There's some two-parameter family here. J and this could be something like vorticity. Or something, I'm not sure. But anyway, but there's a sequence where these are actually, their shape is fixed in the inertial frame. If you take a Maclaurin spheroid and subject it to gravitational radiation, it moves in this sort of direction. It doesn't move down like that. It moves right out away from the axisymmetric, the nice axisymmetric solutions. It goes out into some other space and eventually winds up into a state where it's no longer radiating gravitational waves. And this track is determined, actually, if that's vorticity, the track would be at constant vorticity. So I don't know what I plotted here. But this track is determined by conservation of vorticity because gravitational radiation conserves vorticity. And so you find the Dedekind ellipsoid that has the same vorticity as the Maclaurin spheroid you started with, and that's where you wind up. It's a perfectly well-defined trajectory, and it doesn't follow this, which is the analog of what I'm trying to say was the simple model of nice axisymmetric solutions. So. That's what happens in the strong gravitation, in the gravitational wave dominated case, where viscosity is not very important. When dissipation is important, I'm sure you stay closer to this track, but I'm not sure what is actually going on. Right. 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 That's exactly right. Yeah. So These are understood, and all I'm saying now is that this happens in general, and that it requires a conspiracy. It seems to me on the viscosity to stay right on this track or so close that it doesn't matter. I'm not sure. I mean, I don't think. Yeah. I would say no. I would say if you really want to do what Patrick was telling us we want to do, which is to track the phase evolution of the gravitational waves over the whole evolution of the system to one cycle, then I think no, it's not good enough. No, I know, that's right. But but you want, you know, you said good enough, so I have to take a criterion of what is good enough. And if that's the criterion, then I think clearly we have to do better. I would like to say one other thing, which bothers me, is in the model where you stick close to the rotating star, then the R mode is always in always unstable and always has two-thirds of the of the angular velocity, and that tells you what the gravitational wave frequency is that you track. And so we have this feeling that we're tracking the gravitational wave frequency going down in some smooth way from the starting frequency down to wherever the mode gets stable. If you're in this regime, then very quickly you wind up with a shape, well, or with some conspiracy, some amount of viscosity or something, you wind up with a shape that may, in fact, be rotating rather slowly in the inertial frame. And in that case, I would guess that that dominates the gravitational wave signal, but that there may be perturbations on that, analogous to the R modes of that system, which are somehow still there. So you might actually find that the gravitational wave signal is split between a couple of different frequencies. I think the situation could get very complicated, but I guess that perturbation is probably a small component of the energy, and most of the energy will come out with the angular velocity omega star, as I call it. But it's probably very weird. Yeah, but I think there's some reason for believing it. As you evolve to the nonlinear regime, you probably see this splitting happening, and then one of them becomes dominant. That's right. The problem is it may be very hard to maintain all these constraints, and if the viscosity is large enough, you're also going to have trouble with the differential rotation. So the natural way that even the gravitational radiation will act is to give you some differential rotation, and then the question is, you know, can you cope with the heat that's being generated by that and the cooling timescale? So I think you have a number of constraints on how the star can readjust itself. That's what I think. And I think you put it very well, because up here, on the Dedekind ellipsoid, you now have zero gravitational radiation, but you still have a lot of internal kinetic energy. The star is still internally spinning quite fast. We've assumed that the R modes are really significant because we can get rid of all the kinetic energy of the initial star. If this happens in very quickly, you may wind up with all the kinetic energy still inside that star and not having been radiated away. So I think even the energy budget, the total energy lost in R modes, is sensitive to this evolution question. No, the Dedekind is an ellipsoid. The humps don't go away. The Dedekind...
No, I'm not saying they're going away, but when you're going along this track, what happens is that you roll the
Yeah, well, that's what I'm saying you can't do. That's what I'm saying is not accurate enough. It's not, you can talk in that language, but the system is so distorted that there's no axisymmetric equilibrium which
for,
well, that's right. But then I think you have to regard it as an equilibrium itself. Yeah, I only drew this as an analogy. This is the F mode evolution. This is not the R mode evolution. I only drew this as an analogy. I don't claim that the density distribution, the shape of the star in density, will be highly non-axisymmetric. The velocity pattern will be, because that's what we're looking at with the R modes. But to me, that's not, you know, that doesn't, it doesn't matter whether we're talking about density or velocity. We're talking about non-axisymmetry. Yes, that generally it will somehow not be described, you know, I guess that's what I'm claiming. I'm certainly claiming that it's not describable by a small perturbation on an axisymmetric stationary background. And that this is, and the key thing is that this depends upon the thermal effects. If the thermal energy generation is very small compared to gravitational radiation, the picture will be very, very different from the one that we had in that paper. If thermal energy generation is very close to the factor of two of the energy loss to gravitational waves, then maybe we're okay with that picture. But I think that's the key thing, is that you've got to look at how the thermal energy behaves. Yeah.
I think that the point beyond which a Maclaurin spheroid becomes unstable through deformation into a Dedekind ellipsoid is such that the instability is secular and you need dissipation because you have to break conservation of circulation to make the transition. And I think the key physical issue here is whenever you generate a wave, any kind of instability, the level of on the level at which nonlinear dissipation sets in, if nothing else. Sometimes it would be linear, but then it would grow. So in any kind of evolution of plasma waves and so forth, you always have to consider at what amplitude the plasma wave starts to shed its energy by nonlinear processes. Here, I think you have to ask at what amplitude an armload would start to undergo circulation non-conserving effect due to various nonlinearities. And then you would know how far from, how close it could remain to an axisymmetric evolution.
Well, I don't think I'd accept all of that, but the mode is, I mean, the mode, the key thing that gravitational radiation breaks is conservation of angular momentum and not of circulation. So that's what sends it off in the direction of the Dedekind. If you then have on top of that dissipation, what's playing a role in my calculation is not the breaking of vorticity, although that happens. What's playing a role in my calculation is simply the generation of internal energy, and I'm giving an argument that isn't prescriptive. It doesn't say how the star can readjust itself with that extra energy. I'm just saying, does the star have enough internal energy to reestablish an axisymmetric equilibrium? And I'm claiming that in many cases it won't have enough internal energy to establish equilibrium with the new energy and angular momentum, total energy and angular momentum that it has.
Right. I suggest we adjourn the discussion to the food court.